Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 6, 2019, and the time is 2:35 p.m. With us today is Representative Knopf, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Ortiz, and Co-Chair Wilson. Before us today to begin with will be House Bill 68. Representative Johnston.
Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt CSHB 6831-GH1049-U as the working document.
Hearing no objections, we will have before us as a working document. Would the department like to please come up? As well as we will hear their part first, and then we will go with the changes, the explanation of changes to the CS. I need to go in the right order.
What's up?
Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you. I'm Gray Mitchell. I'm the division director for the Division of Workers' Compensation. And thank you for hearing House Bill 68. As I described this morning, the bill basically merges the Division of Workers' Compensation together with the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. These two divisions share complementary missions and functions, and one works to prevent accidents and the other works to provide compensation for lost wages and medical costs if there's an injury. So merging these two divisions just makes good common sense in a lot of ways. The department is cognizant of the critical roles each division has, and this merger bill will not impact any of the legal or regulatory duties of either division. We aim to take advantage of position vacancies and explore opportunities to streamline processes wherever we can. And we do have a fiscal note that does just that in a couple of areas. We've flattened the management structure in labor standards and safety by reclassifying the division director to a deputy director position, which will focus on the new division's inspection, consultation, and enforcement functions. This will allow for a mid-level management reduction in the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health component. We expect to see additional opportunities to consolidate and share administrative duties between the two divisions as the merger matures. This is not going to happen overnight, but will be carefully developed over time. And the bill does not propose to change, again, any of the functions of the two divisions. And we expect it to produce opportunities as the year progresses to share resources and be more efficient and effective as we move forward to deliver the services of the two divisions. With that said, Madam Chair, would you like us to discuss the fiscal notes at this time, or should we?
I think we should probably hear what else is in the bill. So if Ms. Gaddis could please come to the table, put herself on the record. Mr. Mitchell, you could stay there because part of the addition also has to do with an ask that your department had as well. Ms. Gaddis.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Lynn Gaddis, staff for Representative Wilson. And I'll lead you through the changes. Page 7, lines 20 through 22, grandparent was added to section 23.10.330A, exempted employment, which would allow a child to work in a business that is owned and operated not only by a parent, but by a grandparent as well under this section. Page 7, line 26, 17 was changed to 16 to remove authorization of work requirement for a 16-year-old. Page 8, line 3, 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. was changed to 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., defining the time during a day that a 14 or 15-year-old child may perform work outside school hours. Page 8, lines 8 through 15, a new section was added to define the conditions and hours during a day that a 14 or 15-year-old child may perform work between June 1st and ending the Monday of September of each year as 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. And that explains the changes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions about the original bill or the changes? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to wrap my head around this last change you just mentioned. You give a date. Let me find this here. A minor who's 14 or 15 years of age may be employed during the period beginning June 1 and ending Monday of September each year, first Monday. We're not allowing them to work from September through. Is that what this is reading?
No. So, Representative Knopf, there are two times that are designated for youth 14 and 15 years old. The time when they're in school, they will be able to work between 7 a.m. and 9 p.m. When they're out of school, they will be able to work from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. There are two different standards for the time of year that it is. So, yes, we're willing to let them work when they want.
I guess I just find it odd we even need to put a time and period in there. If there's a job available and they're available, they should be able to go to work. I'm not quite sure why we're doing that.
This is current law. There's the Fair Labor Standard Act from the United States government has been the one who has decided that we should have hours within it. What we had previously was 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. I spoke with the U.S. Department of Labor to understand why they have those. And I could only imagine that back in the day, they probably abused children and were working them in times that they should be in school versus out there working. And so now you don't just have times. So there's even an amount of hours per week that you can also work, all within the Fair Labor Standard Act. Okay. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would there be an advantage to moving that date from June 1st? Would that be forward or backwards to May 20th? Most high school graduation dates fall before May 20th, just trying to buy them another 10 days of summer employment. Would that be a concept that we could embrace?
You can embrace it, but the federal government will not embrace it with you. But most of the designation really is whether or not the child is in school or out of school. But that's where all this came from, was the federal government. Any further questions? I'm going to open up to public testimony on HB 68. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on HB 68? Is there anyone online? Seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony on HB 68. We will now go through the fiscal notes. Please put yourself on the record and walk us through the fiscal notes. We would be very appreciative.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Fiscal note one is for our workers' compensation component. This is a zero fiscal note. We don't anticipate immediate savings in workers' compensation as a part of this merger, but we do expect that there might be out-year savings. We just can't identify them at this point in time. Fiscal note two is for our occupational safety and health component, and this is where we are finding savings, as Director Mitchell articulated earlier, in some administrative support and some mid-level management. The total savings is $283,000 of workers' safety compensation administration account funds. Do you want me to read the whole thing?
Oh, I think we'll see if there's any questions, but I appreciate the thought. Representative Knopf.
Thank you.
Would you like her to read it to you?
No, but I am curious. So you're showing a reduction in $283,000 personal services line, but I see they're DGF funds. So are they interagency receipts, or are they program receipts, or just, and how do you, what happens to these receipts now, and what happens to the savings, I guess, is my question.
Through the Chair, Representative Knopf, they are designated general funds. It's the Workers' Safety Compensation Administration account. It is a fee on insurance premiums that goes into a designated general fund account that can go towards workers' compensation and safety program administration, which is what we use it for. This will be a savings to that account. the money will stay in that account for future year spending.
So,
follow up?
So we don't expect to see any, thank you, Paul. We don't expect to see any reductions in the premiums that employers pay then in that regard, huh?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the cost savings won't result in premium savings, but there have been premium savings, so the revenue coming into the account has been lower, and this will help us stay within that lower revenue amount.
Thank you.
Any further questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside, and I'm going to ask for any amendments by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Representative Knopp.
I want to make a brief comment, Mr. Mitchell. You know, this is the first department, first thing I've seen towards true consolidation and efficiencies in this administration other than cost shifting and some other things. So this is, I think, a lot of what the public has asked for when we're trying to right-size government. So I do appreciate your efforts at what you're doing here, and this is what I like to see.
Is there a way in the House Finance to say thank you?
Thank you.
So any other questions? Seeing none, we're going to set the bill aside. We now have HB 31 before us. And everybody gets it together. So I am going to move amendment number one.
Object for purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Vice Chair Johnson. I appreciate that. Amendment number one was brought to me by the sponsor of the legislation, so I'm going to let him address what it does and why we are changing the amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for reference, the committee amendment number one is work draft U.8, and this would change the transfer from the earnings reserve account to the principal to $9.61 billion. There are supporting materials that I know are outside the committee room, and at least on the floor, I attempted to get to most, although I don't think I got to all members with those materials to make sure people are in receipt of it. But effectively, the $9.61 billion figure is premised on the notion of keeping three times the 5.25% POMV draw in the earnings reserve account and transferring the remaining cash in the earnings reserve account to the principal.
Questions? Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had some modeling scenarios in the presentation that you previously gave us the other day. Did you happen to have this amount modeled so that we could see how that looks?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, 1 second, pulling up the models in question from the slideshow. Representative Tilton, through the chair, two of the models from the moderate bear market that were presented, one represented an $8 billion transfer, one represented a $12 billion transfer. So 9.61 specifically was not modeled, although it obviously falls between those two.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, in your PowerPoint from the first hearing at page 7, you noted, following up on Representative Tilton's question, that in a moderate bear market spanning 3 years, with an $8 billion transfer, we would theoretically, according to one scenario, hit an account of $5 billion. So necessarily that number must be lower because we're transferring another $1.6 billion. So my first question is, should this give us concern? So here I'm referring to this item here. The dip there in this model must be lower. Why shouldn't I be concerned about that?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, you're right, the dip would be lower than in the $8 billion model, and of course it would be substantially higher than the $12 billion model from that slide in question. To share the thinking behind leaving three times the draw in the earnings reserve account, the thinking is that it protects a substantial amount of cash forever in the permanent fund, which I think is broadly a goal of the legislature, while basically striking a balance and leaving significant shock absorption in the earnings reserve account. And I would note that the third of the, and maybe to speak to that a little bit more, the third of the three supporting documents that the committee has charts the balance of the ERA through time from 2000 to 2019. And you can see in them, this was prepared by my counterpart in the Senate. And so you can see what the balance of the earnings reserve account has been through time. And if $9.6 billion is transferred from the earnings reserve account, you're going to have about $9 billion remaining in the earnings reserve account, which is basically north of, well north of the average from 2000 to 2019. So we're still north of average, and we've done okay through time. So that's sort of the thinking in striking this balance. As you can see, I mean, usually we were in the $2 billion, $3 billion, $5 billion range in the earnings reserve account through time, and we'd still be north of those ranges.
Follow up, and we also have legislative finance here if anyone has a question for them as well. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Kress Tompkins, can you tell us the derivation or how you derived the 9.61? Where does that, like, why isn't it 9.62 is really sort of my question.
Absolutely. Representative Josephson, through the chair, and the approach was derived in consultation with a couple of committee members and just broadly consistent with the POMB approach. Not to use a prop, I don't know what the rules are in this committee, but this slide sort of speaks to the math behind the 9.6, which is you need just shy of $9 billion. $8.79 billion is three times the 5.25% of market value draw based on FY20, the FY20 POMB draw. So if that's the amount that you want to leave in the area as the shock absorber or sort of the minimum sufficient balance, everything else would go to the principal, and everything else according to using current account balance from APFC for the earnings reserve account is $9.61 billion instead of $9.62 or any other number.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kress Tompkins, with me being the original sponsor of HB 31, I obviously support the idea and the goal behind putting money into the corpus of the permanent fund. My question about moving the figure up to 9.6, when we were calculating that, based on your explanation so far, I understand that it was within consultation of different groups within this body. Did we look at the impact of previous major crashes in the market, significant stock market crashes back in 2008 or something like that, and the impact of those crashes on the earnings reserve at that time? Did that go into this calculations to try to prepare for worst case scenarios?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I can speak personally, have been cognizant of the potential of market corrections, I guess as the jargon goes, sort of great recession-esque events. They'd be significant, yeah, it would be significant.
I think Ortiz is wanting a more detailed answer of modeling-wise what happens if we put this amount in versus the 5.5 that was originally before the committee.
Yeah, and I guess maybe to put more clarification on the question, if we were to see a significant correction similar to recent major corrections that have happened in the market. Would that, with this movement of the 9.6 billion into the corpus, would there be the potential of, with a significant correction, would there be a potential of us in that particular year following that particular crash not being able to put out a PFD?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I think it would be helpful to bring Ledge Finance up for that question. But yes, I mean, there is that potential. You know, to some extent, there will always be that potential so long as we have a permanent fund that is structured with an earnings reserve account. And, you know, like, this is, like, truly the heart of the question is, like, what is the right balance? I mean, so long as we have a permanent fund that is structured with both an earnings reserve account and a principal, which, as I think the committee knows, I think is sort of, that's a unnecessarily complex structure, and having a true endowment is much safer for the state of Alaska and much more sustainable. So, I mean, the preface is, I think we should, like, the reason this is even a problem is the reason we should move away from this structure of the permanent fund. But so long as we do have the earnings reserve account within the permanent fund, there's always the risk that it will zero out and bottom out. And unless we're, you know, committed to sort of protect against the fund bottoming out in any scenario, then, I mean, you know, if that's going to be our sort of North Star principle for managing the fund, we should always leave as much cash in the earnings reserve account as possible, $18 billion, $20 billion, $22 billion. Obviously, there's a downside to that, too, which is the risk that the fund gets rated beyond sustainable means, you know, in some future year, whatever the political winds of the time, however they're blowing. And so that's the balance.
Thank you.
I'm not sure who's going to rate it, but I can only imagine. Mr. Teal, could you please come and help us a little bit about this? And Representative Christ Tompkins, I would not move from the table if I were you. I'm pretty sure we're going to have more questions. And I guess not just this amount, Mr. Teal, but if you could address, you know, whether or not we would be smarter to start with maybe possibly a smaller amount and continue to put it in as we see those adjustments. I guess we're just trying to, I think we all understand that we would like to keep it protected as much as we can, but trying to figure out that sweet spot of the right number.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And I think Representative Christ Tompkins answered the question pretty well in saying no one actually knows. Just remind you that back in 2008-2009, we nearly ran out of earnings reserves, which would have meant no dividends were payable. It wasn't until June of that year that we knew that dividends would be paid. So it is not merely a remote possibility of running out of money in the earnings reserve. It depends on the earnings. Right now, the earnings reserve balance is very high for a couple of reasons. We've had a terrific earnings recovery period, roughly a 10-year bull market, and we did an inflation proof for 3 years. So the earnings reserve account is extraordinarily high right now. I would say with its current balance, the danger is pretty low of running out of reserve balance and being able to pay the dividend in the near future. However, I think you all realize that the more money you take from the earnings reserve to protect the principal or protect that money from raids, however you want to state that, then the more danger there is of running out of money and having not only no dividends payable, but no POMV payout to the general fund either. So the consequences of an error here are pretty substantial. That said, the slide on the screen right now starts with an earnings reserve balance of $18.4 billion. Okay, good start. but you should know that that includes the unrealized earnings as well. For the last several years, the unrealized gains have been assigned in proportion to principal and and to the earnings reserve account. So roughly $2.4 billion of that balance is unrealized gains. And because they're unrealized, there's no money there. And the money cannot be spent. So the more proper starting point is about $16.6 billion. And now, if you were to take the other slide that shows moving $9 billion of that, I don't know. Yeah. Can we?
I don't think it's on
this. It isn't on the deck. We don't know, but do they have this slide as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody has a slide in their packet.
There's a slide moving 9.6. Well, really, if you wanted to take these same numbers and say, we just want to multiply the payout of approximately $2.9, $3 billion a year and multiply that by three, fine, that's $9 billion. Now, if you're going to say, we're going to move $9 billion aside, you're not really doing that. You should be subtracting the unrealized balance from that. And really, it's only $7.8 billion or so that's available to move. And when you move $7.8 billion over to the corpus, the unrealized gains assigned to that cash move with it. So it's important to realize, it's important to understand that you really want to look at realized earnings here, not total value of the earnings reserve account. So this moves perhaps $2 billion more than Representative Christ Tompkins may want to move, but we didn't discuss this issue, so I don't know how many people are really aware of the assignment of the unrealized gains, but it makes a substantial difference. Also, when you move earnings, the cash earnings from the reserve account into the corpus, you then begin inflation proofing that much more money. We inflation proof only the principal, not the earnings reserve account. So moving money over would increase the amount of inflation proofing by $100 million or perhaps more, perhaps $150 million per year in the future. So it's a little bit more complicated than simply taking the money, but I think your question really aims at, so how much can we move and still feel safe? The more you move, the less safe you are. That's about as detailed as I can get. There's no number because we cannot predict what the market's going to do. We do know, because we've seen the earnings reserve account respond very quickly to downturns in the market.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you through the chair. First of all, I would like to suggest that saying that we cannot divest ourselves of the realized gains and the earning reserve maybe is taking it up one step beyond. It's not that I understand what you're saying with the how we allocate the realized gains, but in a desperate or in a spend thrifty market, if there was interest in those funds, we could divest ourselves of the realized gains. Wouldn't be pretty, but we could. Is that correct?
Representative Johnston, through the chair, it's not the legislature's choice to do that, but the permanent fund could certainly make that choice. Who knows? They might have made that choice in 2008. We don't know. They say they didn't. The market just recovered enough and they had sufficient money. But yes, they could sell stocks and turn unrealized gains into realized gains, real cash.
And a follow-up, what I'm saying is that, and 2008 would have been a perfect example when we were under and at one point did not have the funds to pay a dividend, but we, as true Alastans, we always got a second chance. But what I'm saying is when there's a structured draw, the permanent fund then looks at their portfolio and figures out how to address that draw. And sometimes it's taking from realized gains, sometimes it's taking from cash position. But one of the best things about having a structured draw, it gives them the opportunity to plan that draw. But a follow-up to that is at any time this legislature can draw from the earnings reserve with a basic majority vote, and then the permanent fund has to respond to that and find the cash, because it is in the so that's, I mean, we're, I understand that you and I are kind of and going down a little bunny rabbit hole, but I just wanted to say that once the legislature decides how much they want to draw from the earnings reserve, then it's up to the board and the fund to come up with those funds, and it just needs to come from the earnings reserve account.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, it's possible to do it that way, but I think the law right now limits the draw to the cash available. And in fact, current law says you'll pay dividends if there's money in the earnings reserve account. We know that the permanent fund could realize gains if it came down to that, like in 2008, and they did not have sufficient cash to pay dividends, and then in the last month of the year may have sold off things, made the gains, and the cash was there. But the way the law reads is that if there isn't sufficient cash in the ERA to pay out the dividends and now to pay out the POMV payment, then it doesn't occur. So it's the permanent fund that manages cash versus and right. realized gains versus unrealized gains.
And a follow-up, and I will say, since we have such a diversified, far more diversified portfolio than we've ever had, and some of our unrealized gains or long-term gains and assets that are hard to, that there would be no market in. And so it limits the amount of cash that you can get from them. But I'm also saying that there is a risk associated when we think of this in terms of, and I agree with you that whatever we take out in this bill has an effect on the realized gains. But there still is a risk in the legislature on how we address those realized or what we ask the fund to do, is my only point. But the question I have for the maker of this, because I will say that Mr. Thiel brought up an interesting point. And whether I completely agree with it or not, but I question one of the ways we could look at this. I know that you used three times the draw, this year's draw. And because we have had such a good market, next year's draw is going to be better. And would it be splitting this baby if we maybe amended it where we looked at a $3 billion annual draw three times, so you'd need keep $9 billion in the earnings reserve and take the rest and put it in the corpus?
Representative Tompkins.
Representative Johnson and Madam Chair, I view that as a friendly amendment and, I mean, ultimately defer to the wisdom of the committee. I think that's fair, and I sort of feel good about, personally, I feel good about this sort of general range of sort of how the cash in the earnings reserve account gets divided between cash that's kept in the earnings reserve account and cash that's moved to the principal for the benefit of future generations. And just one other comment I would make, given Mr. Thiel's comments, which I think are helpful, is it's also worth noting that under Senate Bill 26, the size of the draw will get proportionally a little bit smaller when it goes from 5.25% to 5% a year or two out, or what have we. So that's just one other thing for the committee to keep in mind.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Philosophically, I'm right on board with you on putting money away into the permanent fund for savings. It makes good fiscal sense. I think the question is how much and what time. What is the risk we're talking about here, right? I think it's impossible to assess the risk of this action without answering the other questions that are before us. Spending, what does that look like into the future? Revenue, what does that look like into the future? These are things that would be addressed in a comprehensive fiscal plan. So my question would be, which is kind of an unfair question, I think, but it's, and maybe rhetorical, how does this plan fit into a comprehensive fiscal plan for the state?
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, rhetorical and unfair questions are fair game. and I don't think that's an unfair question. I think it gets at it. An important question about, you know, the premise of what are we thinking about when we assess what is the right amount to keep in the earnings reserve account versus to put away forever in the principal. Certainly, I mean, even, you know, down to this slide, thinking about how many times a percent of market value draw might you keep in the earnings reserve account is the premise that the legislature will not overspend the permanent fund, that it won't take unstructured draw, you know, being the jargon, in the future, more than 5.25% or soon 5% of the market value. That is certainly a premise here. You know, if it's the intent of the legislature to go greater than that amount in the future, that's a whole nother conversation, and that would also run crosswise to at least my thinking, and or that sort of guides what amount is the right amount to keep in the earnings reserve account. And, you know, if we're thinking we might start taking more than 5.25% of market value out of the permanent fund in the future, that would certainly affect this conversation, but it would, I think, create a lot of other conversations, or I hope it would. So I hope that is helpful. That's just all to say an assumption or premise is that the legislature this year and in future years, regardless of how it spends it on dividends or public services, won't take more than the percent of market value set forth in Senate Bill 26.
Yeah, I guess the follow-up statement I would make is that we don't have a long-term fiscal plan that this fits into. We are looking at this in a snapshot of this year, and the next year we will look at it as next year and the following. There is no long-term fiscal plan. We're just swinging at a best guess right now.
I've been here for 9 years looking for that plan, Representative Carpenter, and I think the reason that this bill is actually in front of us is because there's not a plan, and the past plan has been to utilize our savings no matter how they dwindle down. I believe there's an amendment we're going to go to on this, and then we're going to go to Representative Knopp next. Representative Johnston?
Yes, I'll make this either as amendment number two or a friendly amendment.
Amendment one to conceptual amendment one to amendment number one.
Instead of inserting $9,610,000,000, I would insert $9,900,000,000.
Object.
You're going higher?
Is that what you wanted to do? I thought it was.
Did I say, no, I'm sorry, did I say eight?
Would you like to restate your motion? Because I think what you thought you said and what you really said were two different things. So please restate your motion.
Sorry. Oh, God, senior moment. I would like to insert $8,900,000,000 in place of $9,610,000,000. That's less.
I'll object.
Object.
And we'll keep this conversation going. I think at this point, I don't think anybody feels safe on any amount. Would you like to withdraw that for now until the discussion
okay.
finishes? So we're going to remove that friendly amendment that we're not sure how friendly it is yet. So Representative Knopp. Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is to Mr. Teal. Has the permanent, and maybe this isn't a fair question because the permanent fund itself are not represented here at this meeting, but has our risk profile changed much in the permanent fund itself over the last 10 years that you know of, the way we manage our assets? I mean, the fund has grown, but is the risk profile, the mix, if you will, between domestic, international, real estate, debt, are we still managing the fund basically the same we did 10 years ago? Or do we know?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, I know that they've changed it. I think it was probably 4 or 5 years ago they had an investment manager up who changed asset allocation, which naturally changes your risk profile. They are more heavily invested now, I believe, in privately placed investments, and we still have a lot of real estate investments and other non-liquid investments. So I can't answer the question whether it's riskier or less risky, but I can say the profile has changed somewhat.
Yeah, it's not a fair question. If the permanent fund director were here, she may have a different answer. But my sense of this whole discussion is maybe that dollar amount should be around $8 billion. That's my suggestion.
I kind of thought that's where my comfort level was at one point. Mr. Teal.
Well, I think it may help the committee to realize another point here that the risk involved in this can be controlled by the legislature to a great extent, and that's because you have control over inflation proofing. And if this doesn't crash all in 1 year, but you see a down market, the legislature could say, we're not inflation proofing this year. Okay, you immediately increase the earnings reserve balance by $1 billion or so. So this is a dynamic situation that you as legislators can control as long as the crash doesn't happen all in 1 year, in which case it's going to be too late for you to respond.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to inflation proofing, I believe last year the legislature put in $950 million or somewhere close. Do you recall what it is this year? I just don't have it in front of me, but what's being proposed for inflation proofing this year, Mr. Teal?
Through the chair, this year's inflation proofing was expected to be about $943 million, but that's an estimate.
Sure. So,
follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair. My comment is such that I was comfortable with the $5.5 billion. I'm not comfortable with the 9.6. My thought was with the inflation proofing that we have, if we could add that, what did you say, Mr. Teal, $943 million? If we could add that then to the $5.5 billion, I'd be comfortable with that. Just as a discussion.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think based on what we've seen in the wide variation of figures, first of all, coming from the other body, I think it was $12 billion. And then we've ranged around a few billion here and there amongst this particular discussion. It highlights what Representative Carpenter was saying in this and what Representative Price-Tompkins was saying at the beginning of his presentation. Really, we just don't know, and we could come up with any figure today between the 5 point and the 12, and I'm sure we could have justification for the figure. The real issue is if we, and I think we all are on board that we want to protect the permanent fund for our future generation, that we really want to do that. If that's our priority, and a priority is to continue to distribute APFD, which I think is a priority amongst many people here, we need to be moving towards merging the two funds together and limiting ourselves to a draw constitutionally. And that's really where the fiscal plan starts, is in that realm. It's merging the two funds together, limiting a constitutional POMV, and obviously there'll be a lot of discussion as to what percentage of the POV goes to services versus the permanent fund dividend. But really, if we're honest with ourselves, if that's what our goal is to protect the permanent fund and to protect a PFD distribution, that's where the answer is found.
Well, although I appreciate that, that is not the bill before us. And so at this point, this has been great discussion. The question is, you know, first of all, this would be a one-time, let me make sure I make this correct, this assumption correct. This is a one-time move within this bill. Is that correct, Representative Christ Tompkins?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Is there a figure around the table that someone is comfortable with to put out there to get chopped up? Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move $8 billion as a substitute for the, on line three, $9,610,000,000.
So conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one is $8 billion. Any objection?
I object.
Representative Josephson, would you like to speak to your objection?
Sure. I was also going to say $8 billion until Representative Sullivan Leonard made her point about the inflation proofing. I'm more comfortable at $7 billion.
So the inflation proofing could be taken out of the operating budget if this were to pass, which would get you the same $8 billion, I would think, that it would be the intent of the legislature that if this bill passed, that it would be looking at that amount, not necessarily the combined amount, and we can make sure that that is, you know, on the record, you know, on this portion of it, as well as we'll go to the floor for that. So any other, okay, so we have an objection. And so any other discussion? Hearing and seeing none, take the roll on $8 billion.
Representative Joseph.
As to the amended amendment, no.
Representative Johnston?
Yes.
Representative Knapp?
Yes.
Representative Laban?
Yes.
Representative Merritt?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
No.
Representative Tilton?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
With six yeas and five nays, $8 billion is the conceptual amendment to amendment number one. We have amendment number one now as amended before us. Is there any further discussion on amendment number one? Is the objection maintained on amendment number one as amended?
If it is,
do we still have an objection? Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Johnston.
Yes.
Representative Knapp.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Merritt.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes.
Representative Tilton.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Eight yeas, three nays.
Thank you. I'm sorry, with eight. Eight yea to three nays, the amendment as amended has passed. So we now have the bill before us. Is there any more discussion on the bill that is before us? What is the will of the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I move HB 31, version 31-LS0287/U as amended from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection?
Objection.
Please call the roll.
Representative Knapp.
Yes.
Representative Laban.
Yes.
Representative Merritt.
Pass.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes.
Representative Tilton.
No. Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Merrick?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
8 yeas, 3 nays.
With 8 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 31 has passed from committee. We have the paperwork to sign. Tomorrow's meeting is at 9 a.m. We will have House Bill 68, Labor Standards, Safety Worker Compensation, HB 75, Internet for Schools Funding, and SB 29, Extend the Board of Marine Pilots. Is there anything else to come before us today? Seeing, hearing none, it is 3:25, and we will see you at 9 a.m. Please stay to sign the paperwork. We are adjourned.